Everybody, thanks for sticking around for part B. No need for explanation or introduction for this episode because it's a continuation of part A, which if you did not listen to, make sure you go back and listen to part A. This is all one giant episode broken into two segments. So if you don't listen to part A, you miss out on some crucial details. So let's get into it. Part B, the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Okay, so we're not jumping directly into the Battle of Little Bighorn because there is some background information that we have to go over first. But for all intents and purposes, this episode is the short amount of time before and including the Battle of Little Bighorn. So in essence, this is the episode. I'm really excited about it because, man, did I put a lot of work into this and I hope it comes through. It gets a little scattered and geographical, but man, I really feel like this could be one of my best episodes, and I hope you agree. I hope it's as interesting to you as it was to me. But anyway, let's get into it. So 1875 and 1876, the U.S. was trying to negotiate with the Sioux for ownership of the Black Hills. Of course, as we talked about last episode, they found gold there, but that was sacred land to the Sioux. The negotiations, of course, broke down. The Sioux did not want to give up the Black Hills, and President Grant decided to go the way of forcible removal. So he told the tribes that they had until January 31, 1876 to report to the reservations or the army would forcibly remove them. So they gave them a peaceful option with the threat behind it, kind of the carrot and the stick deal. Now this threat included the Powder River tribes of the Sioux, like Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull, who of course thought this was a funny joke and had no intention of obeying. However, many Sioux did reluctantly obey. This was more out of necessity than out of desire, of course, hence reluctantly. The buffalo was running out. They were unable to support their way of life as they had in the past, as their ancestors had. The buffalo were being killed out by hunters and railroad men, and it just wasn't sustainable anymore. So by 1875, the number of hostiles had gone from about 10,000 to around 3,000. However, 1876, there was a bit of a change. Some of them changed their mind and decided, reservation life ain't for me. And they headed back north to join up with the hostile bands in the Powder River area and others. Sitting Bull was part of this. He had actually sent runners out to the agencies or the reservations. When I say agency, that means like the Red Cloud Agency, this Spotted Tail Agency. It's reservations with that name attached to it. And Sitting Bull sent runners inviting warriors to return to the north for a big fight. They knew it was coming eventually, and they wanted to get a bunch of men together. Crazy Horse went to the Cheyenne and gave them the same invite, and many of them could not turn it down. It was not something that they could resist a good fight with the whites, and for at least a short amount of time, returning to the ancestral ways of the Sioux and the Cheyenne. Now, Crazy Horse and the Ogallalas, as well as Sitting Bull and the Hunk Papas, were camped by the Rosebud Creek in eastern Montana. So Ogallalas from Red Cloud's camps, the Red Cloud Agency, and Bruels from Spotted Tail joined, and then came the Cheyenne. There was also Blackfeet Sioux, Sans Arc, Santee, and some Assiniboines, I think is how you pronounce it, I should have looked that up, and Arapaho. So it's a large conglomeration of different tribes. Now, part of it was many American Indians, even on the reservations, felt unsafe, and they joined the growing camp of Sitting Bull, basically out of the necessity for protection. Protection in numbers. And when I say Sitting Bull's camp, like I said, I didn't go into Sitting Bull's biography, because I obviously didn't have time, but this was Sitting Bull's war. He was the man in charge, even if he didn't have an official title, so to speak. Now, it's impossible to say how many joined up with Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull. But in terms of warriors, not non-combatants like women and children, but warriors specifically, it is basically impossible that there could be less than 2,000. But also on the flip side, it's probably impossible that there could be more than 4,000. So there's somewhere in that range, 2,000 to 4,000 warriors, a large scale grouping of warriors, plus all the non-combatants like women and children and old men. They were better armed than any camp had been in quite some time. They probably, about half of the warriors had guns. Some of them had some high quality repeaters, which we'll get to later. But for the most part, despite being better armed, it was still old fashioned flintlocks, condemned muskets, muzzle loaders, smoothbore rifles. I mean, it wasn't, for the most part, the high quality carbines that the cavalry would have. But they were well armed. But don't mistake that being well armed for what the army said it was. The army would later say that they had better arms than even the 7th Cavalry or the rest of the army. That is an exaggeration. The army was not outgunned, but it was more equal for the first time. Now, despite knowing that the war was coming, the American Indians at the Rosebud were in a joyous mood. Many of them later on testified that this was the happiest summer of their entire lives. There was nearly continuous dancing, which is a big deal in the Sioux and other tribes' traditions. Dancing was ceremonial and religious and just part of having fun as well. There was plenty of food. They had had successful hunts, so they were eating as much as they wanted, dancing. It was the closest the Sioux would ever come to presenting a united front. And there was also maybe what you'd call a little bit of a joyous desperation. The Sioux, as well as the Cheyenne and the Arapaho and the others, but mainly the Sioux, knew that this would be probably the last big gathering ever. Their way of life, as they knew it, was ending. This is the last big fling before they were probably going to be forced to move to the reservations permanently, for all the reasons I had already mentioned. Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull, of course, did not feel this way. They talked about fighting to the last man, but for the vast majority of the people in these various tribes, this was the last hurrah, and they made the most of it by being as joyful as possible. Now, a huge camp like this can't stay in one spot for very long. They had probably somewhere to 15 to 20,000 horses and ponies. Obviously, they're going to eat a lot of the natural vegetation that's around. So they moved around. In June of 1876, this huge camp moved to the Little Bighorn Valley, and then they stayed there until basically that could not support them anymore, and they moved back to the Rosebud. So they're bouncing between the Rosebud and the Little Bighorn, and it was at the Rosebud where they held a Sundance. So if you're a little bit squeamish, this might be a part of the episode to fast forward. It's nothing terrible, but you've been warned. So the Sundance is the most important religious ceremony of the Plains Indians, which of course would include the Sioux. And it was traditionally held once a year in late spring or early summer, but more elaborate Sundances could sometimes be held when they were at or near large encampments, like this Sioux encampment at the Rosebud. Now, generally speaking, the Sundance in itself was not something that everybody in the encampment partook of, but only a few volunteer individuals would agree to this ritual, which was quite grueling, so it was definitely not something that was forced on anybody. So when the community gathered, specific members would set up the dance structure, and this was a central pole, and it was a connection to the divine, which was embodied by the sun. That's why it's the Sundance. They're basically worshiping the Great Spirit as seen in the sun. Now, other dances could be done before the Sundance to ritually prepare the dance ground, but the main item of business was the Sundance performed by a select few who called themselves supplicants. So supplicants who pledged to do a Sundance were usually doing so in fulfillment of some sort of vow or searching for spiritual guidance. And they danced at the appointed time, and they continued intermittently, but throughout this Sundance, they were not able to eat food or drink. And they would dance sometimes until exhaustion set in or until they got their vision that they were hoping for, things of that nature. But it could go on for hours and hours. Now, oftentimes, the Sundance would take on a bit more of a brutal tone, at least in our eyes, we would see it a bit more brutal. Mentors to the supplicant would pierce the skin of the supplicant's chest with a slim skewer of bone. And they got in there pretty deep. And then they would attach something heavy to that skewer using leather thongs, such as a buffalo skull or something similar. And then the dancers would drag that object throughout their dance until they either succumbed to exhaustion, or as often happened, until the object got so heavy that it ripped the skewer from their skin. And I couldn't find the source for it. I know I read it in a book at one point when I was a kid, because it stuck in my head very distinctly. There would even be times where the skewer would be into their chest far enough that the muscles would actually be pulled out of the skin and be exposed before things would rip or they succumb to exhaustion. So, horribly painful, I imagine. Oftentimes, instead of attaching a buffalo skull, they would use the leather thongs to tie the dancers to the central pole, and the dancers would lean back or even hang from the pole without touching the ground until they pulled free again, until the skewers were ripped from their chest, which could take some time. Now, this wasn't, it was commonly done, but not as common as just a normal sun dance. This was usually performed just by the most committed supplicants. So it was not something that happened at every sun dance, is how I understood it. Now, at the Rosebud, Sitting Bull was the sponsor and leader of this particular sun dance. And it was not his first time. He had the scars on his chest to prove that he had been through the sun dance before, maybe more than once. But this time, his Sundance looked a little bit different. He sat with his back to the pole. His adopted brother, Jumping Bull, which I think is hilarious, Sitting Bull and Jumping Bull, the adopted brothers, used an awl, and a sharp knife to cut Sitting Bull's skin. Very small cuts, little pieces of his skin taken off, but Sitting Bull had 50 small pieces of flesh cut from his right arm, and then 50 more on his left. So even really small pieces, that had to be excruciatingly painful. And then, with blood streaming down his arms, Sitting Bull danced around the pole, staring at the sun. Horrible idea, it seems like, but that's what he did. Seems excruciating, honestly, in every way, but it was a religious ceremony that had to be done at this point. Sitting Bull was looking for a vision. He danced for 18 hours straight until he fainted. From loss of blood or exhaustion, I guess, I don't know. He was revived. A woman in the tribe, I can't remember her name, she threw water on his face, woke him up, and as soon as he revived, he said that he had a vision, and Sitting Bull's vision foretold the camp being attacked by soldiers who would all be killed by the American Indians. That's a good vision to have before you're going into war. So, it was a joyous sun dance for the Sioux. But soon after the sun dance, the Sioux had run out of forageable material around the Rosebud and had to move back to the Little Bighorn. And soon after that, Cheyenne scouts reported that a column commanded by General Crook was coming north with roughly 1,000 men. And now is where we get into the real nitty-gritty meat and potatoes of the Battle of the Little Bighorn. This is not going to be a short description, so buckle in. There's a lot to take in, but this gets good. So the Battle of Little Bighorn is famed for being Custer and the 7th Cavalry's last stand. But before we even get even close to that, I want to point out a misconception that I believed for a very long time, and that was that every soldier that marched out to this battle was killed. That is inaccurate. As you'll see, even some of the 7th Cavalry survived. That's how we have primary sources for this. But there was still Custer's last stand, which has made it famous. But I just want to get that misconception right out of the way. Because when we talk about General Crook and the Battle of the Little Bighorn, That was all part of it. Custer was only one of three prongs sent out by General Sheridan. So they were planning to go out, capture Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, and the rest of the hostiles, or at least the vast majority of them, so that they could get the hostiles onto the reservation and basically be done with the American Indian Wars in the West. General Sheridan wanted a three-pronged campaign. Custer's 7th Cavalry would march west from Fort Lincoln in the Dakotas. Troops led by Colonel John Gibbon would march east from Fort Ellis, which was based in Montana. And then troops under General Crook would march north from Fort Fetterman in Wyoming. So coming from the west, the east, and coming from the south to the north. So three-pronged attack. Now each group was referred to as a column, so you'll hear me use that word interchangeably. And it didn't start out well for Custer, because as he was preparing the 7th, Custer was called to D.C. to testify about corruption in Grant's War Department. Horrible timing for Custer. And despite the fact that almost everything he said was speculation or hearsay, Custer implicated Grant's Secretary of War, who had already resigned. But more importantly, Custer implicated Grant's brother, Orville, in this corruption. And I'm not going to dive into it. There was shady business going on, and it got brought to light partly because of Custer and his fame and his testimony, but there was just a lot of corruption going on. But one way or the other, Grant's brother was dragged into it by Custer, and Grant was pissed. So pissed that he blocked Custer from returning to his regiment. Planned on throwing the book at him, basically. But he was eventually talked down by, I think, Sheridan, mostly, and relented and said, okay, Custer can go back to the 7th and go out on this campaign, but there's the caveat that Custer's direct superior, Brigadier General Alfred Terry, was named the leader of the campaign. So Custer was not the man in charge. It was General Terry. So at May 10, Custer finally gets back to Fort Lincoln and starts preparing for the expedition. Now, Custer, as is his normal procedure, would not be without family on this expedition. Going along with him was Tom Custer, who we've talked about, the 2-time Civil War Medal of Honor winner. There was Custer's brother-in-law, James Calhoun. He was a first lieutenant in the 7th. Tom and George's younger brother, Boston Custer, was going along as a forage master. And then there was Henry Armstrong Reed. I'm struggling. I am mispronouncing words today. Henry Armstrong Reed, Custer's nephew, who was also nicknamed Audie, just like Custer was back in the day, was going along to help drive the beef herd. So it was a Custer family reunion, basically. Now, right from the get-go, Custer divided the 7th into two wings. And one of them was commanded by Major Marcus Reno, and the other was commanded by Captain Frederick Benteen. We've talked about, for sure, Benteen. I don't remember if we talked about Reno. Either way, remember both those names. They are incredibly important going forward. And it was a little strange that Benteen was given charge of one of these wings, because it was well known that Benteen hated Custer. And I'm sure Custer didn't feel too strongly about him either. And everyone knew it, so everybody was a little surprised by this. But while in D.C., Custer had discovered that Benteen was cousins with Lawrence Gobright. Now, Lawrence Gobright is the co-founder of the Associated Press. And Benteen has gone on record saying that he suspects his command was a play by Custer to avoid bad press. May or may not be true, definitely seems within Custer's character. Now, to be fair to Custer, Benteen basically always disliked his commanding officer. He said later in life, quote, "I've always known that I had the happy facility of making enemies of anyone I ever knew." So don't put it all on Custer. Frederick Benteen was not a guy that was easy to get along with. So May 17, Custer's column made ready to leave Fort Lincoln. And strangely enough, the wives of the men leaving, for whatever reason, many of them all seemed to have this premonition of doom. Now, this seems like hindsight being 2020, but there was more than one woman before the men had left who were begging their husbands, don't go, stay home, something, I don't have a good feeling about this. Even Libby, Custer's wife, was heard bemoaning the fact that her husband was leaving. She was overheard telling him how she wished Grant had kept him in D.C. and that he wasn't able to go on this campaign. And this is a woman who was married to Custer through multiple campaigns in the West against the American Indians. This is a woman who had been with Custer throughout the Civil War when he was in battle regularly and never seemed to share these misgivings. And suddenly now, all of a sudden, she has bad feeling. Now, Libby accompanied the men for about the first 15 miles of the march. And at one point, she looked back and she saw something else that added to the dread she was already feeling. The sun was dissipating the fog, and a mirage had appeared in the sky. And about half the column that was behind her was reflected into the sky. So it appeared that they were marching both in the sky and on the ground. Now, you can say this sounds like superstitious hogwash, but actually this has a scientific explanation. It's called the superior image. Nathaniel Philbrick, who wrote the book The Last Stand that I used heavily for this episode, says, quote, light rays from the warm upper air had caromed off the colder air in the valley below to create a duplicate image above the heads of the troopers, which is pretty cool if you're not Libby Custer, because she does not know the scientific reasoning behind what she's seen. What she thinks she's seen is ghosts. And she feels that she is seeing the future of Custer's column, which cannot be a good feeling for the wife of the commanding officer. But obviously none of this is going to change Custer's mind. Libby ends up going back after the first 15 miles or so back to the fort, and Custer and his column continue on. By May 27, the column had reached the badlands of the Little Missouri River. Now, this is where Sitting Bull supposedly was going to be, according to their intel, but of course we know that's not true. And he was long gone. So, Terry just wanted to be sure. He decided to send Custer on a recon mission. May 30, Custer and a select group of his men headed out, and of course, they find nothing. One of the reasons maybe that Terry sent Custer out on this wild goose chase is by this point in the march, General Terry was beginning to be a bit fed up with Custer. Custer had promised Terry that he'd be on his best behavior and that Terry was the commanding officer and Custer would do nothing without his approval. That was a total lie. Custer was often straying from the column and had a tendency to just basically do whatever he wanted. That was not making Terry very happy as the commanding officer, and it led to some tension. Early June 1876, Terry left the encampment and rode to where the Powder River and the Yellowstone River met. At this point is where he found the steamship, the Far West, captained by Grant Marsh. And that steamship was part of the campaign, and it carried supplies for the expedition. So Terry orders the Far West to take him down the Yellowstone. He goes and meets up with Gibbon and his men. And Gibbon reported that he had seen a large encampment of American Indians on the Rosebud, but was marching away from them as per his orders for where everybody was supposed to meet up. Terry orders Gibbon to halt and went to meet up with the rest of his men. Now, Terry did not want to head directly to the Rosebud. First, he wanted to make sure that there were no hostiles in the Powder and Tongue River area. So there's three main rivers in this area, the Powder, the Tongue, and the Rosebud. They know for sure that at least in the area of the Rosebud, there's a large encampment, but they want to make sure that there are no others on the other rivers. Obviously, rivers are where many of these tribes are going to locate just for ease of living. Terry met up with Gibbon, and then headed back to Custer at his encampment. Custer wants to break free. Custer wants to get out from under Terry's thumb and engage the enemy, but Terry is not convinced that now is the time. And he decides to send out a scouting party. Again, very cautious, not a bad thing, but not the way Custer does it. Terry decides to give the scouting party command to Major Reno, not to Custer. It's a little bit rubbing Custer's nose in the fact that he is not in command and Terry will do as he sees fit. He's kind of sticking it to Custer, saying like, hey, watch yourself. I'm in charge. Start doing as I say. So Major Reno gets the command. Nobody really expected him to find the enemy in the Tongue and Powder River area, but they sent him out anyway. The goal was regroup at the mouth of the Tongue River after Reno's scout and then engage the enemy that was most likely going to be found on the Rosebud. Terry wanted to make things clear. Things happen on my terms. Custer is not in charge. It's very petty. It was all petty and political. So the reading ahead in my notes. All right. The 7th set up a command post on the Yellowstone River and waited. Waited for Major Reno. Now, Major Reno was not a man who generally would take the initiative. So what he did next surprised everybody. He decided, in his words, quote, instead of simply finding where the Indians are not, why not try to find where they are? Which makes sense, but is also potentially insubordination and disobedience of his orders. So he was supposed to continue down the Tongue River until he got to the Yellowstone, and that's where he would meet up with Terry and Custer again, who would continue their march towards the rendezvous with Crook and Gibbon. So once Reno got back, according to the plan, at that point Custer was supposed to take 9 companies of the 7th, march back up the Tongue River, and cross over to the Rosebud. Gibbon was supposed to march up the Rosebud from the Yellowstone River at the same time, and Custer and Gibbon would then find and crush the American Indian encampment in between them. Your classic pincer move. But Major Reno did not abide by the plan. He was convinced by a guide, a man named Mitch Boyer, that the village would have moved by now, so they're not going to find anything on the Tongue River. And he decided to head west towards the Rosebud. That was the last place anybody had heard of a large encampment being. Stumbling like a drunk. So he figured he would at least find evidence of Sitting Bull's village, and then he could return to Terry and better inform him where the village had most recently been and in what direction they were heading. Now at 6 a.m. on June 15, Custer led his men up the Yellowstone towards the Tongue River and his supposed rendezvous with Reno. They left behind infantrymen to guard the supplies that they left at camp, and they also left their sabers, which were rarely used in the Indian Wars, but many of the cavalrymen felt naked without them. But they were traveling light and fast. June 17, Major Reno found the trail of the village on the Rosebud. He wanted to pursue and attack and be the hero, but he was convinced by a scout that if he did go, based on the size of the village, based on the evidence they could see, if Reno went after them, they would almost certainly be killed. So using better judgment, he decided disengage, go back to Terry, even though he disobeyed orders, go back and give Terry the vital intelligence that he acquired. So he and his column was ordered back to Yellowstone. Now, unknown to Reno, Custer, Terry, or anybody in that area, at the same time that Reno was scouting the Sioux had found General Crook and his men, which we kind of talked about at the beginning of this episode. On June 17, Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, and the 700 Sioux and Cheyenne warriors spent the night riding up the Rosebud and they attacked. Crook's troopers were not prepared for a charge, so initially they were saved by the Crow and Shoshone scouts that they had. They were the first ones to engage the Sioux who were attacking. After 20 minutes, cavalry troopers finally were able to get organized and engage the Sioux, who reluctantly retreated. But it was not the end of the battle. The battle did not end until there had been about 6 hours of fierce fighting, and the Sioux and Cheyenne finally decided that they had had enough. Crook had claimed victory, but he decided that he didn't have enough ammo or supplies to continue on, so he marched south a day, the opposite direction he was supposed to be going, and made camp near modern-day Sheridan, Wyoming. One of the reasons this was significant is this was the first time a large group of warriors had sought out and attacked a large column of soldiers. Crook was convinced he was outnumbered, which is probably false, and he was also convinced that he was outgunned. Who's to say? But in reality, Crook and his men were frightened. They were frightened that they were attacked instead of being the ones attacking. And Crook said he never forgot the war whoop of the Sioux and the Cheyenne. So it got into their psyche. Crook sent messengers to Fort Fetterman, who sent word back to General Sheridan, but Crook never sent word to Terry or Gibbon. He remained at his current camp at a place called Goose Creek, like I said, near Sheridan, Wyoming, modern day. And he stayed there for 6 weeks. He did not pursue Sitting Bull or Crazy Horse, as was expected. And it was not until July 9, 2 weeks after the Battle of Little Bighorn, that Terry got news of Crook's encounter. So the one person who probably would have benefited the most did not get news from Crook. Massive breakdown in communication. So we move on to Monday, July 19, moving along towards the battle, slowly but surely. General Terry is about 125 miles north of Crook. He received word from Major Reno, who admitted to disobeying orders, and Terry is livid. He is livid that Reno did not abide by the plan. Terry, General Terry, was very by the book. You have a plan in place, you follow the plan. Custer was livid, but for a totally different reason. He was livid at Reno for not attacking. He figured they found the trail of the Sioux encampment. You should have gone all guns blazing straight ahead and done battle. Custer even penned an anonymous letter to the New York Herald suggesting that Reno should be court-martialed for cowardice. Seems a bit extreme. That did not happen. Just FYI. June 20, Custer, Terry, and Reno reunited, and Terry came up with a new plan based on the new information that he unveiled to his men on June 21. So the best guess was the Sioux were somewhere near the Little Bighorn River. So Custer was to lead the 7th up the Rosebud. Terry and the Montana column would work their way up the Bighorn to the west, and then they're going to meet up at the Bighorn, but they're taking two different routes. This is where I'm not very good at describing. I'm not good at painting a picture geographically, let's put it that way. So I'm doing the best I can, just bear with me. So Custer's line of march was much shorter than Terry and Gibbon in the Montana column. Terry is going to join up with Gibbon in march with the Montana column, as opposed to staying with Custer and going with the 7th Cavalry. Why? Honestly, I couldn't tell you. So, Custer had much less distance to cover, so Terry ordered him to continue south, even if the trail of the Sioux went west. Doesn't seem to make much sense. He was to march all the way nearly to the Wyoming border before he would head west. This would make sure that the time of his arrival at the Little Bighorn was fairly similar to General Terry's and Gibbon. It would also mean that for a good portion of his march, Custer would be marching away from Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse. Now, these orders seem ridiculous. Custer had just reamed out Reno for not attacking. And it seems crazy to think that Terry would have any belief that Custer would postpone an attack. Now, of course, we have the benefit of hindsight being 20/20. And after the disaster, many officers stated that if Custer had obeyed, the combined strength of Terry, Gibbon, and Custer could have given them the victory. This does not seem genuine. This seems like people trying to cover their own butts after the fact. The chief of Gibbon's scouts recorded in his diary at the time of the planning meeting, quote, "It is understood that if Custer arrives first, he is at liberty to attack at once if he deems prudent," end quote. An interpreter, Fred Gerard, also says that he overheard Terry repeat the verbal instructions given to Custer, quote, "I told him if he found the Indians not to do as Reno did, but if he thought he could whip them to do so," end quote. So despite the fact that Terry had an official plan in place of all of them meeting up together and crushing the Sioux together, unofficially, it seems pretty clear that there's evidence that Terry gave Custer the leeway to do as he saw fit when he got there, knowing that he would get there first. Now, with the policy in place and with history on their side, the worry was not that the encampment was too large for the army to handle, because they've been whipping encampments for a decade now. They haven't had much trouble. Surprise attacks and everything have worked fantastically. And that's the plan going forward. So the worry wasn't that they were going to lose. The worry is that the village would see them coming and scatter. And the army would lose their chance at a resounding victory. So the unwritten plan was for Custer to move quick, attack from the south, and while the slower moving Gibbon column with Terry joining them blocked the north, they could kind of herd the Sioux towards the Gibbon column, and eventually they would all be rounded up in a rout that would be Custer's great victory. But it all depended on speed. So Custer, knowing that he had to move quickly, declined to take the Gatling gun because it was too hard to move. Major Reno had taken it on his scouting expedition, and it was a pain in the ass. They just couldn't move it. It got stuck. It was heavy, and it slowed them down. Custer decides not to take it with him. He's got to move quick. He also declined the offer from Gibbon of 4 additional companies from the Montana column. He figured the 7th Cavalry was plenty, and he could whip them without additional men. So on June 22, the 7th Cavalry begins marching at noon. Gibbon claims that he told Custer, quote, "Now, Custer, don't be greedy. Wait for us," end quote. To which he claims Custer responded, "No, I will not." So later that night, when they make camp, Custer had a meeting with his officers. And there are multiple reports that said that Custer did not seem to be himself. He was seemingly depressed. He felt the need to explain all of his decisions, which is something he had never done. He was usually a, here's my order, obey it, get it done. But this time he was explaining everything he needed to, and he was belittling his officers, like especially Reno and Benteen. All the companies now reported directly to Custer. So he had gotten rid of the structure of having 2 wings, one under Benteen and one under Reno. Everybody reported directly to Custer, which basically left Reno, especially, with no official duties anymore. Again, Custer was very upset that Reno had not attacked and was considering him a coward, and this was the way that he was getting back at him. Now, after this meeting with the officers, there's 4 lieutenants, Godfrey, McIntosh, Gibson, and Wallace. They're walking back to their tent, and Wallace spoke up. He said, quote, "Godfrey, I believe General Custer is going to be killed," end quote. "Why, Wallace, what makes you think so?" "Because I have never heard Custer talk in that way before." So things were just off. June 22, they continued along the trek, following the path carved by hundreds or thousands of travois poles. They knew they were on the trail of the Sioux, and they were just following along, waiting to find them, waiting to find them, waiting to find them. Custer began to realize, seeing the trail that he was following, that there were more Sioux and Cheyenne in this village than he figured. However, he was still confident in success. When asked about it, he said, quote, "What the 7th can't lick, the whole U.S. Army couldn't lick." So they were ready for battle no matter what. 7:30 a.m., the 7th came across the site of Sitting Bull Sundance. So they're getting close. And they're about 50 miles southwest of the actual encampment of Sitting Bull's village that was near the Little Bighorn. The encampment was in a beautiful valley. It is, from pictures that I looked at and from testimony of people that have been there, it is a absolutely gorgeous piece of land. So it's a great place for Sitting Bull to make his camp. But also, it was a defensible area. On the east side of the river is a ridge of rolling hills. To the south, the hills stand up against the river, but it's a steep bluff up to 300 feet. And then downstream to the north, as described by Philbrick, quote, the hills back away from the river and soften into undulating grasslands that look bland enough from a distance, but are cut and enfolded in deceptively complex ways, end quote. That's important later on. Now, Custer was camped near the American Indians Trail, which had veered away from the Rosebud towards a divide in the west. There was a divide. I don't know why I had to say that twice. On the other side of that divide is the Little Bighorn Valley. Now, Custer had assembled his officers that night and told them that this Crow scouts had marched to the divide, and they claimed that the trail of the Sioux went down into the Little Bighorn Valley. Unfortunately, the glare from the setting sun prevented them from seeing any sign of the village, but they knew that that's where the village had traveled to, at least. During the night, the Crow and the other scouts were heading back to the divide, hoping to see some actual tangible sign of the village. Now, Custer wanted to get his column as close to the divide as possible. So his plan was to march all night, spend the next day scouting, and if everything went to plan, they would march for the village the night of the 25th and attack at dawn on June 26th. Sometime around 2:30 or 3 a.m. on June 25, Lieutenant Varnum was scouting with the Crows in the valley of the Little Bighorn. They were not in the valley, but they were scouting down into the valley. Varnum could see nothing, but the Crow scouts, according to Varnum, said, quote, there was a large village behind a line of bluffs and pointed to a large pony herd. At 5 a.m., Varnum sent two Arikara scouts back to Custer and reported that the Crows had seen, quote, a tremendous village on the Little Bighorn. So Custer now has official word of the actual location of Sitting Bull's village. At 8 a.m., Custer leads his column to the west. Now, on the other side of the divide were two groups of Sioux. These are not part of the village. It is just two very small groups. This is where things start getting very tricky. On the other side, one of the groups was a man named Crawler and his 10-year-old son Deeds. They were looking for Deeds' horse, which he had abandoned after it became exhausted when he was out the day before. Now, Crawler noticed a cloud of dust rising from the other side of the divide, which would have been Custer and his men, but he did not immediately assume it was soldiers. There was a second group that was led by an Ogallala named Black Bear. They were actually leaving Sitting Bull's village. They were from the agency. Some of Sitting Bull's warriors had taken some of Black Bear's horses from the agency when they had left, and Black Bear was there to get them back. So he had actually got his horses. He was going back to the agency after getting what was stolen from him. Now, the Crow Scouts had seen both of these groups, and they were convinced that they had been spotted and that the element of surprise was gone, and they were trying to tell Custer that he needed to attack. Custer refused. He still believed that they had the element of surprise. But it was shortly after that his brother Tom came back with some more bad news. There was a man named Sergeant William Curtis. He had left behind some personal belongings after the 7th quickly took off on a march, and he had gone back to where they had camped before the march and found three Cheyenne trying to open a box of hardtack that was left behind. So it was now clear that the column had been spotted. The element of surprise was gone. Even if they hadn't been spotted, they had left behind enough evidence. Those Cheyenne were clearly going to go back to the village and tell them that there was a army, so to speak, close by. So Custer calls his men together. This is midday on June 25. And he had told them about the groups that they believed now had seen the column and were probably reporting back to the village. He had hoped to postpone the attack into the morning of June 26th, but because they believed that the element of surprise was gone, they weren't worried about being attacked. They were worried about the village scattering, and they decided to attack at once. Once the order to attack was given, Frederick Benteen was the first officer to offer up his company to join up with the attack, which surprised Custer because he did not expect Benteen to be on his side about any decision. So originally Custer gave Benteen the advance, and then he regretted it. He was fed up with the pace that Benteen was setting, and probably he was jealous that Benteen was leading as opposed to himself. So Custer ordered instead for Benteen to take three companies and head to a line of bluffs 2 miles to their left. And he told them to find a perch where he could observe and make reports on the battle. Part of this was probably to get Benteen out of the way, but there was also Custer's obsession that no Sioux escape. And by putting Benteen where he ordered, he probably hoped that that would prevent some Sioux from running off in that direction and escaping the 7th Cavalry. But whatever the reasoning behind Custer's decision, the long story short is that Custer's orders to Benteen took 20% or so of his unit's strength away from the site of the village. And it's never a good idea to divide your force, especially when you already know that you're outnumbered. But that's just the way it is. At this point, Custer also gave Reno command of three companies, finally giving him some official duties again. Reno was ordered to continue down the left bank of a tributary called the Sundance Creek, while Custer led his men down the right bank. Now, Custer soon realized that the land was deceptive. Again, remember, these undulating grasslands, as Philbrick put it, were deceptively complex, and Custer realized that where he had sent Benteen had no chance of seeing the Little Bighorn or the village, and so he sent a messenger telling Benteen to move to the next bluff, and if that didn't work, then go to the next and the next. So Benteen is moving on trying to get a good vantage point. Now, Custer is desperate for information, but he still could not see the village that the Crow scouts insisted was there. He is going into this blind. Custer and his men come upon a small village. It had just recently been abandoned. Only one teepee remained. This location thus becomes known as the Lone Teepee. So they are still finding evidence of Sioux in the area, but they haven't actually seen the village themselves. An interpreter, Fred Gerard, we talked about him a little bit earlier, rode up to the top of a knoll that overlooked the Lone Teepee. He saw clouds of dust rolling up from the Little Bighorn Valley. He misinterpreted this. He shouted to Custer, quote, "Here are your Indians running like devils," end quote. So once again, Custer, with bad information, is starting to think that this large village, hopefully the site of his massive victory, is starting to scatter and run. So he rethinks his strategy. If the American Indians were fleeing, the size of the village didn't matter. They were on the run already. They're not going to put up a fight, is what he's thinking. So what matters is getting into the valley as soon as possible and capturing as many Sioux and Cheyenne as he could. Then they could drive the rest of them towards Terry and Gibbon and win a massive victory. So, Custer changes his plan. He sends orders to Reno. Quote, "Mr. Gerard reports the Indians are 2.5 miles ahead and running. Move forward as fast a gait as you think prudent and charge as soon as you find them, and we will support you with the whole outfit," end quote. So Reno gets his men into position. As this was happening, there were multiple reports from his men that Major Reno had already at this point consumed a considerable quantity of whiskey and still had his canteen with him. That's important information that will come into play again. Now, it's around this time that Frank Girard changes his story and informs Reno that despite his earlier reports, the village was not running away, but, quote, the Sioux are coming to give us battle, end quote. Unfortunately for everybody involved, Reno hated Girard and completely ignored him, and he ordered his men to keep marching on. Girard felt that he must report this to Custer, so he galloped off. Now, Custer had finally been able to get into a position where he could see the village. It was the largest Indian village that any of them had ever seen. There were hundreds of teepees, and they estimated about 15 to 20,000 horses. On the flip side, it seems that Custer had done the impossible despite their misgivings and managed to catch Sitting Bull's village by surprise. When Custer first observed the village, he saw women and children and dogs, but no warriors, so they surmised that maybe the warriors were sleeping or off hunting. Custer saw this as a massive reenactment of the Battle of the Washita. Reno would gallop in from the south, Custer would gallop in from the east, they would capture hundreds, maybe even thousands of non-combatants, and when the warriors returned from the supposed hunt that they were on, they would have no choice but to surrender, and they would all head to the reservations. At 3:30 p.m. on June 25, Custer shouted to his men, quote, hurrah, boys, we've got them. We'll finish them up and then go home to our station, end quote. So Reno and his men were in position, and they begin their charge. Now, Custer could not necessarily see warriors, but there were warriors, obviously, knowing what comes next. There were warriors in the encampment, and they were starting to get into position to defend against Reno. So Reno could not see much that was in front of him. There were some warriors that were riding back and forth. They were kicking up dust. They're basically making like a 1876 smoke grenade style. So all Reno could see was dust. Can't see the encampment, but he realizes as he's charging in that this feels very much like he's being drawn into an ambush or a trap. Now, Reno is often, after the fact, accused of cowardice, especially given the fact that he did not attack on the Rosebud. But this is a false charge. He is not a coward, but he is blitzed on whiskey at this point. And obviously, that is affecting his judgment. So, in the middle of his charge, when his men need strong, decisive leadership, Reno was drunk. He was afraid, and he was hesitant, according to Nathaniel Philbrick. And it was about the time that he started seeing the top of the teepees from the village that he decided this maybe was not a good idea. He was starting to get an inkling of what he was charging into and how large of a village this was. And fearing a trap, he calls off the charge. He commanded his men to halt. He commands his men to dismount and fight on foot. So they formed a skirmish line with about 90 or so men. They marched about 100 yards, stopped. Some of them were standing, some kneeling, some laying, and they began firing their carbines. A quarter mile away was the village of Sitting Bull. The women and children in Sitting Bull's village, they could see Custer and his troops, but they could not see Reno until he started firing. And the village started to panic a little bit. Many in the village later on testified that if Reno had continued his charge, the village may have panicked and began to scatter. Women and children were running to the safety of the hills in the west, and the warriors were running for their horses, but Reno stopped. Again, not that he's a coward, but he made a poor decision. I mean, everything's, you know, hindsight. Who knows? He may have charged in and immediately scattered everybody and it would have been a resounding victory. In which case, he's the hero. He may have charged into the village. They may have stood and fought, and based on the numbers there, Reno might have been slaughtered with all his men. But based on the testimony of the villagers that were in the encampment, it seems like the better choice for Reno, especially with what's coming up, you'll hear should have continued the charge decisively, and that would have given him the best chance at victory. But that's not what happened. Pretty White Buffalo woman in the encampment said later, Reno, quote, had the camp at his mercy and could have killed us all or driven us away naked on the prairie, end quote. But instead, the skirmish line was set up, but it was still too far away from the village to effectively use their carbine, which did not stop the men from popping off a bunch of shots. Many of the men started drinking, started shooting wildly. They were even shooting straight up into the air. Horrible idea. Each man had 50 rounds on his person, and their horses had another 50. So, total per man, if they could get back to their horse, was 100 rounds, and they were wasting it willy-nilly. This was extremely precious ammunition that they could not afford to lose. Now, at this point is when the warriors began to mount up, and in the chaos, started to get ready to fight. Sitting Bull told them, quote, warriors, we have everything to fight for, and if we are defeated, we shall have nothing to live for. Therefore, let us fight like brave men. And they charged Reno's men. Estimated about 500 Hunk Papa Sioux were in the first wave that did not break the skirmish line. Say what you want about the 7th Cavalry. They could fight. They could fight well. The Hunk Papa warriors swung right, which would be to the west, and paused near a hill that was just out of range of the troopers' carbines. Now, at this time, there were some older warriors who had mounted up. The first wave was a lot of the younger, more exuberant warriors. Some of the older, more wise men had mounted up by this time and joined the younger warriors by this hill to the west. Others had worked their way around the end of the skirmish line to the south, and still others had infiltrated a timber stand that was to the east. And more were crossing the river and working their way south. If you followed all that, that means that Reno's skirmish line was suddenly in very grave danger of being surrounded. At the same time this was happening, Custer and his men, who were hidden from view from Reno, again, by the bluffs, were proceeding north. Custer was working on incomplete information. His first glimpse of the village was not the whole village. He thought he'd seen it all, but scouts with a better vantage point informed Custer that the village was close to double the size originally thought. And they also informed Custer that Reno had stopped and formed a skirmish line. Custer and Reno were separated by about a mile-wide stretch of valley. Custer sent a runner for Frederick Benteen and his men, basically telling them, don't wait for the pack trains. Catch up. We need your help. It was a very brief version of the orders. Custer knew that he would need them, need those men. So he sent a runner, told Benteen to catch up. During all of this craziness going on, there's a lot I'm trying to like weave between so many different points of this battle. Crazy Horse was not really involved in the early part of this battle. He was getting ready, but getting ready at a very leisurely pace. The Ogallala encampment was further north of the Hunk Papas, so they were currently not in any immediate danger. So Crazy Horse took his time to prepare for battle, consistent with his boyhood vision, to the point where many of his warriors were starting to become impatient and straining at the reins. Let's go, let's go, let's go. Finally, Crazy Horse is ready. He's fully painted, got the stone behind his ear, got the single hawk feather in his hair, and he starts to gallop towards the foothills. A cry went up that could be heard in the entire village. Crazy Horse is coming. His renown preceded him, and I imagine his heading towards the battle was a major lift to the warriors. Crazy Horse gets to the warriors to the west of Reno's skirmish line. At this point, they are basically uncontrollable. They are fully in the battle lust, blood rage, bloodlust, is strong in them, and Crazy Horse has to work a bit to calm them down. He does not want to charge the skirmish line immediately. He tells the younger soldiers there they must wait until the soldiers start having their carbines malfunction. Crazy Horse knew from experience that the troopers in the 7th Cavalry used copper shell casings. Copper shell casings did not withstand heat as well as modern day bullets. And when a gun barrel was heated up from multiple firings in a short amount of time, the copper encased bullet would often jam and would have to be extricated before the gun could be used, which could be a time consuming event. So, Custer slows the tempo of battle, addresses his men, and gets ready to charge. During the charge of Crazy Horse, Reno decides to pull his men back to the safety of a timber stand, which is where his men had stashed their horses. This was a good place to retreat to, because on the western edge of the timber was a trench, natural defensive position. The Sioux would charge, fire, retreat, and immediately be replaced by another group. But being in the timber, Reno's men were able to fairly decently repulse each charge. So the timber was a great place for Reno to take his men and make a stand. There was the trench to the west, the river was to the east, and with strategic placement of soldiers, they could have held out for a considerable amount of time. But Reno was not in the mood for a siege. He was getting ready to flee. Men were running around. They were trying to find their horses that were stashed in the timber. Reno yelled to his men that if they wished to escape, they should follow him. He then yelled, quote, every man for himself, end quote, and took off, leaving a bunch of confused troopers behind, some of which had not yet found their horse and were on foot with no chance of retreating. A subordinate officer, a man named Captain French, testified later that he actually considered murdering Reno when Reno yelled every man for himself and believes that it would have been a justifiable death. Others saw this retreat as inevitable. They were outnumbered at least 5-1. They were low on ammunition and they had no idea where Custer or Benteen were. So it wasn't the decision to retreat that was unjustifiable. What was unjustifiable is the way Reno did it. He did not organize a retreat that was a defensible retreat with covering fire and things like that. He led a panicked mob on the run. He made no plans to cover the retreat, left them open to being picked off. Later on, Sue testified that they were basically hunting the troopers like buffalo, riding them down and shooting them from very close range. Reno's men were being herded toward a ford that was on the Little Bighorn. And as the troopers got to this ford and went into the water and then tried to make their way up the east bank, which was steep and slippery, that ford became a slaughterhouse. Crazy Horse was right in the thick of it, pulling troopers off their horses, killing them. It was a shooting gallery for the Sioux, and it was an absolute hellhouse for Reno and his men. You can just picture the absolute terror and chaos that is happening at this point. This is approximately 4:10 p.m. 80 survivors of Reno's original 130 men had escaped the timber and made it to the top of a bluff, which later becomes known as Reno's Hill, if I remember correctly. Now, Sioux women, old men, and even children joined the warriors along the river, and they began killing the wounded that were left behind. And the women especially started to take a lead in stripping and mutilating the dead. Reno's reputation by this point is ruined already. Like, he has no chance of recovering from this. The commanding officer, in general, should not be the first one off the field. Should be the last one leading and organizing the retreat and protecting his men. Instead, Reno had run. To justify his behavior later, he claimed that he was not leading a retreat, he was leading a charge, which is a bald-faced lie, but he stuck to it for the rest of his life. When one of the surgeons, a man named Dr. Porter, approached Reno and said, quote, "Major, the men were pretty demoralized," end quote, Reno answered, "That was a charge, sir." Yeah. I got nothing. So while all of this chaos is happening, Benteen is just leisurely marching, despite the fact that he can hear gunshots to the north, but he has no idea the scale of what is happening. And at this point, Custer's messenger reaches him, but due to a miscommunication with the messenger, Benteen thought that Custer had already charged the village and had the Sioux on the run. So he's in no hurry, because in his mind, the battle is already over. It wasn't until Benteen climbed a bluff and saw dismounted soldiers being run down and killed by 800 to 900 warriors that he realized that there was a big problem. And that was also when Benteen saw Reno ride up to him. And Reno says, quote, "For God's sakes, Benteen, halt your command and help me. I've lost half my men," end quote. And Benteen, not liking Reno like he doesn't like anybody, responded simply, quote, "Where's Custer?" end quote. Which was a good question, because Custer had seemed to vanish. And remember that Benteen had an axe to grind with Custer originally because of this belief that during the Washita battle, Custer had abandoned Elliot and his men to death at the hands of the Cheyenne. So Benteen is obsessed with where is Custer. Custer was last seen by Reno's men about a half an hour ago, and then he had disappeared behind a hill, which is common in these bluffs. Now, if Custer had attacked rapidly before Reno retreated, he might have given some support, and that might have saved the day. However, at the most crucial time of the battle, Custer, for reasons unknown, apparently paused for up to 45 minutes. And because not a single trooper from Custer's command survived, nobody knows why. Now, there were scouts, Crow scouts, three of them specifically, who claim to have been with Custer, and they have a story. The scouts say in an interview from 1907 that Custer and his staff dismounted at a natural viewing platform and were watching the battle with Reno unfold. And one of the scouts claims to have scolded Custer for not immediately charging in to relieve Custer, to relieve Reno, excuse me. And Custer is said to have replied, quote, "No, let them fight. There will be plenty of fighting left for us to do," end quote. And it wasn't until Reno had retreated and Custer had the village to himself that Custer began to descend the bluffs. It's an unverifiable story. And there's evidence that I don't necessarily want to go into to support the idea that this story was embellishment at best or made up at worst. It's just, there's nothing to back it up. And that's what's so frustrating about this. It will never necessarily be known why Custer did not attack. What was he doing when his men were being slaughtered? But there's only ghosts that can tell us. So maybe one day we'll find out when we get answers to all our questions. But the point is, for whatever reason, there was a large gap in time where it seems like Custer could have gotten into the battle and he didn't. And it wasn't until about 4:25 p.m. that Custer's battalion finally engaged the enemy. We're going to come back to that. Benteen had arrived now on what became known as Reno's Hill, and in the valley below was roughly 900 warriors. And then suddenly those warriors left and started to head north. Towards Custer, most likely. Benteen did not go north to follow them. He resolved to wait for the pack trains. He could have left Reno and taken at least some of his men and headed north to where the battle was obviously happening, but he did not. There was a man under his command named Captain Weir who tried to convince Reno and Benteen to head north to help out Custer, try to at least connect with Custer's command, but they refused. So Weir took his D troop and went on their own. It was about this time that the pack train showed up. Reno was drunk, still drinking, and the rest of his men, both Reno and Benteen's men, were lazing around. They didn't even have a skirmish line out. They were demoralized, and it showed. Finally, about an hour later, Benteen decided he had to go north, and he took his remaining companies and headed out, and they eventually hooked up with Weir and D Troop, which were at the top of a bluff that would eventually be called Weir Point or Weir Peak. To the north, again, they could see a large group of people they originally thought was Custer, but after looking through the binoculars, they concluded it was not Custer, it was some Sioux, and the Sioux were racing towards them, and Weir and D Troop were in a bit of danger. So there's potentially hundreds, maybe 1,000 warriors coming after D Troop. D Troop formed a skirmish line, and it was about this time that Benteen arrived and realized, oh boy, we may have bitten off more than we could chew. They were hoping to get Custer's attention before falling back to their original position, but they never did connect with Custer. But Benteen was determined not to let what happened to Reno's command happened to his own. It would be an orderly retreat. Speaking of Reno, his battalion had also reluctantly followed Benteen, and Captain French and his men were ordered to form a skirmish line behind Weir's men, while another company was to dismount along the bluffs to the south of the river to prevent the Sioux from overrunning from that area. Captain McDougall, who was under Reno, begged Frederick Benteen to take command overall away from Major Reno, because they all understood that Major Reno was hammered and not in any capacity to have command of this magnitude, and if Benteen did not take over, they would all be massacred. Now, by this point, it is nearly 7 p.m. They have been battling since about 3:30 p.m., and obviously it has not been going well. The Sioux are attacking the men on Weir Peak. They had to fall back to the original position at Reno Hill. It was an organized retreat. They fell back, and Benteen had to take up defensive positions before they got circled. So Benteen finds an area that they can defend without being totally surrounded. It's not a perfect area, but it's the best that he could do. A shallow crater of grass and sagebrush beside a bluff. The bluff was steep enough to protect them, at least on one side, from attack. And then he assigned the rest of his men into an irregular arc out in front of them to protect the other half of the circle, so to speak. Five of the seven companies were on the northern half of the entrenchment, with A Company bridging the gap to the east and H Company assigned to the hill in the south. Obviously, they were focused mostly on the north, where the majority of the warriors were. In the middle of this irregular arc were the horses, the mules, and a field hospital where Dr. Porter was doing his best to take care of the wounded. The warriors were firing into Benteen's entrenchment, and it was coming in hot and heavy. The men basically had no choice but to lay there and take it. But the battle took on a bit of a rhythm. Warriors would blast away for about 15 minutes to a half an hour. Then they would mount and charge. The troopers would return fire. The warriors retreated, were replaced by fresh troops, and the whole process repeated. Now the troopers could see so many Indians down below them that they couldn't all even fit on the firing line. So many of the Sioux and Cheyenne down in the valley were just spectating and watching and waiting their turn. This continued on for a good couple hours until about 9:30 p.m. when it was dark and the firing quit. Despite being exhausted, horribly dehydrated, and badly needing sleep, the troopers used this lull in the dark to build defensive works out of hardtack boxes, saddles, and dead horses, except for H Company, which is the company that Benteen was supposedly in charge of. He had taken command of, obviously, this whole entrenchment at this point, but his company was H Company. They did not build any defensive works, which did not work out for them very well the next day. At about 2:30 a.m., this now being June 26, 1876, the Sioux and the Cheyenne recommenced hostilities. Reno and Benteen's men saw a large group of troopers to the north and thought, finally, Custer had arrived, until they opened fire. Turns out it was Sioux and Cheyenne dressed in their dead comrades' uniforms. Now again, the warriors' fire was coming in hot and heavy, and Benteen decided, despite staying awake all night in the lull, that now, with the fire being heavier than it had been all of yesterday, now was the time to sleep. He retreated from the line and lay down on his rifle for a pillow. Warrior Fire actually clipped the heel off his boot and kicked up dirt right underneath his armpit as he was laying there. But incredibly, Benteen later said, quote, "I hadn't the remotest idea of letting little things like that disturb me," end quote. And he fell asleep right in the middle of a battle. Just, yeah, I can't decide if it's the most foolish thing or the most badass thing I've ever heard in my life. Now, H Company, the company that did not have defensive breastworks, were getting decimated, and they were in fear that they were about to be overrun. So Benteen was woken up, and he was absolutely not happy about it, until he realized that the Sioux and Cheyenne warriors were so close to his men that they were literally throwing arrows at them instead of actually shooting them with a bow and arrow. That's how close they were. They were throwing rocks and dirt and even arrows at his men. So Benteen, when he wanted to be, was an excellent fighter. He was brave and knew the different strategies that he needed within the battle. So he shows that now. He gets reinforcements where they need to be. He rallies his men, and he's pissed. And he told his men that he, quote, "was getting mad and I wanted them to charge down the ravine with me when I gave the yell," end quote. They had no idea how many warriors they were charging into. But on the flip side, the warriors had no idea how many troopers were up on the hill that might be coming down on them. So Benteen, in the lead, screaming his head off with all of his men following, screaming too, poured over the barricades and surprised the warriors. And they charged for about 100 yards and they actually scared off the warriors who kind of scattered and fled. As the charge ended, Benteen shot a warrior in the spine and said he felt extreme satisfaction, but he clarified and said he did not feel any satisfaction because it was something to do with a bloodlust, as, quote, "I'm rather fond of Indians than otherwise," end quote. But instead, he felt extreme satisfaction because, quote, "I was so tired and the Indians wouldn't let me sleep," end quote. Which I think is one of the funniest quotes I've ever read in such a serious situation. The guy just wanted to sleep. And there's this pesky war around him. After the charge, Benteen and his men head back up to the entrenchment, and they realize that there are now warriors massing on Reno's end of the entrenchment. So they just can't win. If it's not one side, it's the other. Reno is still sharing a foxhole and whiskey bottle with Captain Weir, and he is not intending to leave. Benteen finally convinces Reno that a charge must be ordered, and Reno relents, but basically tells Benteen, just get it done. That being said, when Benteen gives the order, Reno got up and charged with his men over the barricade in a very brave maneuver. I mean, like I said before, everybody claims he's a coward. He may be a shit officer. He was not a coward. When his men charged, he was right there with them. They scattered the warriors once again, and they pulled back after about 50 yards or so of the charge. And this siege continued on for most of the day. By 3 p.m., the warrior fire had lessened, and it pretty much had stopped by 4 p.m. And later in the evening, the clouds lifted, and the men in the entrenchment could see that the massive village and their horses were moving away. Major Reno turned to one of his men, Captain Moylan, and said, quote, "For God's sakes, Moylan, look what we have been standing off," end quote. As the village left, Sergeant Ryan and Captain French used their long-distance rifles to fire a last few shots, and Sergeant Ryan would later claim that he fired the very first and the very last shots in the Battle of the Little Bighorn. So basically what it came down to is, as we'll see soon, the Sioux and the Cheyenne had a massive victory. They gave up trying to kill Reno and Benteen because at this point they had achieved what they needed and it was time for them to move on. But Reno and Benteen's men thought this was a ruse until eventually they realized there was nothing in the village living. The battle was over. Fewer than 400 soldiers in this particular part of the battle had held off approximately 2,000 Sioux and Cheyenne in what was one of the greatest sieges in the American West. It was a fierce battle, and Benteen especially, but Reno and his men as well, put up a hell of a fight. And that's what I mean when I say there were some of the 7th Cavalry that survived. Now remember, during this whole fiasco, General Terry was supposed to be marching up the Little Bighorn, was supposed to be there by the morning of June 26, but he was delayed. As they were marching, Terry sent scouts ahead, including some Crow again, and the Crows brought word of Custer's demise to a man named Lieutenant Bradley, who then took that information to General Terry. But it was not believed. It was just too out of the realm of possibility to be believed, is what they thought. On the morning of June 27, a day late, the Montana Column resumed its march, and Bradley and his advance unit reported to Gibbon and Terry, quote, "I have a very sad report to make. I have counted 197 dead bodies lying in the hill," end quote. At that point, General Terry asked if it was white men, and Bradley replied in the affirmative, and it was becoming more and more apparent that the Crow scouts were right and that Custer had met a catastrophe. Terry met up with Reno's battalion. At this point, he is openly weeping, and Benteen asked Terry if he knew where Custer had gone. Terry replies, quote, "To the best of my knowledge and belief, he lies on this ridge about 4 miles below here with all his command killed," end quote. Benteen could not believe it. He was still too stubborn in his view of Custer, still thinking that Custer had abandoned them like he abandoned Elliot on the Washita. So Terry commanded Benteen to take his company and investigate. See for yourself, which he does, and a man under Benteen's command named Private Jacob Adams is the first person to find the dead body of George Armstrong Custer. So now we have to talk about the last stand. We've talked about Benteen and the siege. We've talked about Reno and the charge and everything. But now we got to get to what was Custer doing. And unfortunately, like I've said, because everybody in his command died, we don't really know all of the details. Benteen, when he investigated, could not determine any pattern of how the men were positioned and determined that it must have been a rout or a panic. And of course, we have accounts from Sioux and Cheyenne, who were later interviewed while they were on the reservations, and their stories of what happened, which you can piece together to try to get a picture of the battle. And there's also archaeological evidence, including shell casings and skulls, skeletons, and different body parts that have been found over the years, and science has usually identified who they probably were. And using all of those things, you can kind of piece together the battle. But in the end, there is nothing for sure. Let's put it that way. So I'm going to tell you the story as I researched it, but just keep in mind that this is the best guess of what happened. So Custer started a charge down an area called the Medicine Tail Coulee towards the Little Bighorn. And when the troopers began to cross the river, warriors that were hidden on the western bank started to open fire. Now, there was a Northern Cheyenne warrior named Sylvester Nose Gunn, and his grandmother was at the battle, and she claimed that the troopers were led by an officer in a buckskin coat. That would be Custer. Custer and some of his close-knit clique often wore buckskin coats. So, according to this grandmother of Sylvester Nose Gunn, this officer in the buckskin was one of the first men to get hit. So based on his grandmother's testimony, Sylvester Nose Gunn's maintained that Custer was dead before the troopers even reach Last Stand Hill. So in some cases, this makes sense. If Custer was dead or wounded, it would explain a lot of what followed. Because the battalion, without their charismatic leader, dissolves into panic and is quickly routed. Sylvester Nose Gunn maintains that the battle only lasted about 20 minutes. However, there are holes in this story. There is evidence that Custer was alive at Last Stand Hill. For example, he did not use a normal carbine that the other troopers used that, as we've discussed, used copper jacketed bullets. Custer had what was called a Remington sporting rifle, and he used brass cartridges. A pile of brass cartridges was found, or I should say, a pile of brass cartridges casings were found near his body on Last Stand Hill. So it seems logical to assume that he was firing, but I suppose for sake of argument, you could say that somebody was shooting his rifle on Last Stand Hill. And it's not a leap of the imagination that it would be Custer. It's no guarantees, but it's strong evidence that Custer was at least alive for part of the Last Stand. There is also evidence to support that the battle lasted for upwards of 2 hours, with part of those 2 hours being Custer on the offensive, trying to capture women and children before the Last Stand. So that goes against the claim that it was only a 20-minute battle that was over quickly. So, here's what we think might have happened. And by we, I say historians, even though I am by far the most amateur historian that has probably dealt with this subject. There was a warrior named Runs the Enemy who had battled Reno on June 25. He was returning to the village when he saw two other warriors waving him down and shouting that, quote, the genuine stuff was coming. By which they meant Custer. So he rode to the top of the hill and he saw many, many troopers. Runs the Enemy joined up with other warriors and headed up to the hills where Sitting Bull... They ran up to the hills while Sitting Bull went to the village to prepare the women and children to move. Opposite directions. Warriors went one way, Sitting Bull went the other. Sitting Bull told a newspaper reporter a year and a half later that, quote, we thought we were whipped. End quote. And he was preparing the village to run for their lives. Custer convenes his final officer conference, and he now realizes that he made a mistake and that he should not have divided his command and sent Reno on his charge. But he realized that there was still a way to win the battle, which was to cross the river to the north and take hostages. If he could take hostages at the river, he would force the battle to be completed on his terms, and more than likely, victory would be in hand. Now, looking back, we can say that the smart thing that Custer should have done would be to backtrack, meet up with Reno and Benteen, and fight a defensive battle, but that would eliminate the window for taking hostages. So Custer had a right wing and a left wing. At this point in time, his right wing was commanded by Captain Miles Keogh, and they continued to wait for Benteen. We, of course, know that's not going to happen due to the miscommunication with the messenger in Benteen. So Custer splits his command again. He takes the left wing to go scout out a ford over the river in hopes of crossing the river and taking hostages. It's typical Custer. It's an all-or-nothing approach. He's either going to win the battle or it's going to be over. And some of the men under Custer saw this. They saw it as doomed from the start. the interpreter and scout Mitch Boyer said to a Crow scout nicknamed Curly, quote, "That man will stop at nothing. He is going to take us right into the village where there are many more warriors than we are. We have no chance at all," end quote. Boyer convinced Curly to make a run for it. Curly later on claims to be the only survivor of the Little Bighorn, while Boyer stays with Custer till the end and is later killed, his body identified by historians and archaeologists later on, much later on. Now, looking back at the decision-making and knowing how it ends, we have a tendency to judge Custer harshly, and that's not necessarily the whole truth. Custer is a lot of times portrayed as impulsive, egomaniacal, a fool, and leading his men into an impossible ambush that he couldn't possibly win and dying because of it. But if you look at the testimony of Sitting Bull and some of the other warriors that were in the village, the women that were there, especially when Reno was charging, it was on a razor edge. Custer came very, very close to winning a spectacular victory. So maybe we don't judge him so harshly. Did he make incredibly bad decisions at times? Yes. But it almost worked. And if it had worked, Custer would be remembered as one of the greatest American Indian fighters of all time. But it didn't work, so he's known as a fool. The truth is somewhere in the middle. So, the area that Custer was now marching is crisscrossed by coulees, ravines, gulches, all these types of different low areas that are keep people hidden from view. Like I've said before, the bluffs and the grassland look pretty vanilla, but they are actually crisscrossed with a bunch of hiding spots that can be used by both sides. So Custer is heading north while his right wing waited for Benteen. The Sioux and the Cheyenne were using these hidden ravines to stalk the troopers. And the Sioux and the Cheyenne could see Custer and his men, but Custer and his men could not see the Cheyenne. A warrior named Wooden Leg said, quote, "The soldiers could not see our warriors as they had left," they being the warriors, "had left their ponies and were crawling in the gullies through the sagebrush," end quote. Occasionally, a warrior would pop up and harass the troopers with gunfire and arrow, but for close to half an hour, there was just haphazard and ineffective fighting on both sides. Eventually, Custer and the left wing found a good ford over the river that led to the non-combatants. They figured this is the battle. We're going to cross, capture, and win the battle. So Custer rides back to a nearby ridge. He knows he doesn't have enough men to take this ford and the village by himself, so he waits for Captain Keogh and the right wing, who should be coming up with Benteen any minute now. This goes on for 20 minutes. Custer, more than likely at this point, is absolutely cursing out Benteen. He has no idea that Benteen is in a fight for his own life and that the messenger gave him incorrect information. So it's just waiting and hating Benteen, probably. So he's impatient. He knows that this plan is contingent on Benteen showing up, but there's just nothing he can do. So 20 minutes go by. The left wing begins to trace its steps back. Now, it's possible a messenger from the right wing may have found Custer and warned them about what was happening to the south, as well as the fact that there was nowhere, Benteen was nowhere to be seen, but that is conjecture. Now, Custer could have and maybe should have rejoined his left wing with the right, rejoined the left wing with the right wing at a place called Calhoun Hill. Is the best place for a defensive stand, but heading back to Calhoun Hill meant giving up any plan of attacking the village to the north. Custer still wanted to make that happen. So Custer did not rejoin Captain Keogh and his wing, but instead deployed the left wing in the vicinity of a flat-topped hill about 3/4 of a mile from the right wing. So they are separated, they are stretched dangerously thin, but they are still close enough that, if necessary, the right wing and the left wing could be consolidated. Now, at this point, warriors were streaming over the river, and there was a growing threat to the north that obviously would need to be dealt with. Enemy fire at this point more than likely was a nuisance, but not much of a threat. But obviously that's going to change. On the right wing, Keo deployed his men and waited. They knew the warriors were out there, but they could not see them. To the southwest of this right wing, on a ridge, they could see hundreds of warriors starting to come up from that direction. So this is the beginning of where it starts going downhill. They've been looking. Now they see the soldiers from the Sioux and the Cheyenne. And so Keo orders Lieutenant Harrington and C Company to charge and drive them back. So 40 or so soldiers from this company charge, and they initially took this ridge to the southwest and scattered the warriors. However, soon becomes apparent that the warriors that they scattered were not the only ones around. And it seemed to the men that suddenly warriors started springing up out of the ground. And soon the C Company was outnumbered 20 to 1. Massive amount of warriors in the area. The warriors begin to rush C Company and the skirmish line that they have set up. The men in C Company fight bravely. They have an orderly retreat back to Calhoun, but of the 40 men originally in C Company, only about half of them make it back. And by the time they make it back, unfortunately for all the men involved, Calhoun Hill did not provide much safety. Warriors begin attacking. The fire is coming rapidly. And it doesn't seem to matter how many volleys the troopers on Calhoun Hill send into the ranks of the Sioux and the Cheyenne. They just keep getting replaced with more warriors. There's just nothing the troopers can do at this point. They are completely outnumbered. The warriors had some guns, including some nicer Winchester and Henry repeaters, but they also had a devastating amount of arrows, which, when the troopers are outnumbered this badly, arrows will do the trick just as well as any bullet. If, for example, half of the 2,000 warriors fired 10 arrows during that engagement, that's 10,000 total arrows, which comes down to 40 arrows per American soldier on Calhoun Hill. And I have to feel like that is a generous estimate. A low estimate. That is just as devastating. Nobody did survive, obviously, so that answers that question. It's just an incredible barrage. So during this engagement, there is a Hunk Papa Sioux warrior, a man named Gall. Him and his men were less interested in killing troopers and more interested in getting to the troopers' horses. One, because horses and ponies were basically currency to the tribes, but also if they could take the horses, there was much less chance of the troopers escaping. And they hit the jackpot. They found dozens of unguarded horses. It was a massive breakdown in the troopers' battle formation. The horses should have been guarded, but they were not. Gall and his men found them and stampeded them towards the river. So now the cavalrymen have lost their vitally important horse. They've lost the equipment that they had on the horse, which would include ammunition. And things are going from bad to catastrophic on Calhoun Hill. So Calhoun Hill was to the south. And during this engagement, Crazy Horse now has disengaged from where he was fighting on Reno Hill some time ago and is now attacking farther north from Calhoun Hill. This is from Philbrick. He describes it better than I could. Quote, extending between Calhoun Hill and the flat-topped knob where Custer and the left wing had deployed was a hogback that came to be known as Battle Ridge. End quote. This ridge was a potential pathway for the right wing to head north and reconnect with Custer and the left, but instead, Crazy Horse attacked this ridge and managed to single-handedly cut the command in half, further dividing Custer's forces. When Crazy Horse cut this command in half is when the warriors attacking Calhoun Hill charged. And Witnesses likened it to a flood. Gaul remembered soldiers, quote, shot down in line where they stood, end quote. Lieutenants Calhoun, who is Custer's brother-in-law, and a lieutenant named Crittenden died during the charge, fighting back-to-back, fighting to the last man, basically. And survivors of Calhoun Hill started to flee toward Captain Keogh and I Company. But the collapse happened so fast that Keogh barely had time to mount a defense. To make matters worse, he was wounded. His leg had been shattered. So warriors charged I Company, and I Company were all killed in a bunch, is what Gaul said. The battle at this point was so chaotic and so intense that the black smoke from the weapons had made it very difficult to see. Witnesses said the bullets made a noise like bees, and warriors from the Sioux and the Cheyenne used eagle bone whistles that made a, quote, ear-splitting shriek. So you can imagine it is just a scene of utter fear, utter mayhem, chaos in every single way, and at this point it's basically a slaughter. Some of the troopers were surrendering and asking to be taken prisoner, but the Sioux and the Cheyenne gave no quarter. Everyone was getting killed. A warrior named Standing Bear told his son later, quote, when we rode into these soldiers, I really felt sorry for them. They looked so frightened. Many of them lay on the ground with their blue eyes open, waiting to be killed, end quote. The right wing now had completely collapsed. Survivors were attempting to make their way along the ridge to Custer and the left wing, but not very many of them made it. Of the 115 troopers of the right wing, 20 made it to Custer. This is a quote from Philbrick again, quote, at the northern extreme of Battle Ridge was a flat-topped hill. Here, Custer, his staff, and Yates's F Company welcomed the refugees from the right wing. To their north, the soldiers of Smith's E Company remained deployed in a skirmish line. All around these two groups of soldiers, the ever-growing sea of Indians was moving in, swirling. Two moons remembered like water around a stone, end quote. Basically surrounded, no chance, and this is, in my mind, the picture of the last stand. Small group of soldiers surrounded by a mass of galloping Sioux and Cheyenne. Now, 2 miles away, Sitting Bull is watching this all unfold, and it is all happening according to his Sundance vision. Sitting Bull, unlike Custer, had not divided his forces. He had consolidated his forces, and instead of charging into the enemy, he let the enemy come to him. Which, in the end, turned out to be a brilliant strategy and gave the Sioux the greatest victory they've ever had. But it wasn't over yet. Custer and the left wing assembled around what became known as Last Stand Hill. They began making preparations. The fighting resumed at long range, but the warriors were creeping closer and closer. Everybody knows what's going to happen, I believe, at this point. But you fight to the last man if nobody's going to give quarter. A large number of horses without riders from Last Stand Hill bolted, and this was a diversion. They were hoping that the warriors would go to catch the horses, which some of them did, and about 40 troopers took off on foot for the river. The troopers and the warriors battled. The river was about 3/4 of a mile from Last Stand Hill, and the troopers that were still alive at this point, when they were running, realized they were not going to make it. They swerved to the left towards an area known as Deep Ravine. 30 or so troopers made it to the ravine and tried to take cover, but were met by a mass of warriors and were shot or bludgeoned to death. Later, archaeologists found the bones and the bodies in this ravine and were able to identify some of them. Back at Last Stand Hill, the troopers were down to only a handful. This is truly the last stand. Time is running out. By this time in the battle, Custer had probably already suffered his first of 2 gunshot wounds. if we are to not believe Sylvester Knows Guns. He was most likely still alive. He took a bullet that hit just below his heart, but it is a mortal wound. He's most likely knocked down. He's most likely not able to fight anymore. His brother, Tom Custer, may have come to his aid. This is all conjecture, of course, but it's something that seems believable. Their bodies were found within 15 feet of each other, and there are some historians that think it's possible that Tom Custer, knowing that his brother was mortally wounded and wanting to spare him a death by torture, because obviously, especially the Cheyenne, do not like Custer for what happened at the Washita, it's possible that Tom Custer, was the one that delivered the fatal shot to George Armstrong Custer's left temple. Regardless of who did it, that was the bullet that ended the life of General George Armstrong Custer entering in the left temple and bringing him down on Last Stand Hill. Of all the men in the 7th Cavalry, Tom was always known as one of the bravest, and he was most likely one of the last, if not the last trooper, to be killed on Last Stand Hill. And most likely, he fought ferociously till the end. Knowing he's going to die, he fought braver than any other man. And because of that, after he was killed, his body was intensely mutilated. People suspect that because he fought so ferociously, the American Indians took it out on him after he died. That being said, there were eyewitnesses that testified to the respect that the Sioux and the Cheyenne had for who we think was probably Tom Custer based on his heroic battling. But in the end, he was killed. His body was mutilated. When Tom Custer was found, his head had been bludgeoned to the width of a hand. So my hand's what? An inch and a half at most. Badly beaten post-mortem and barely identifiable. 100 yards to the west of Last Stand Hill were the bodies of Boston Custer and his nephew, Audie Reed, were also found. So the Custer family did not just suffer one loss of this battle. It was a devastating blow to the Custer family. When the warriors determined that all the white soldiers were dead, they started to plunder the bodies. The women from the village took a leading role in the mutilation. Custer's body was not badly mutilated, and Cheyenne legend says he was left alone because he was the husband of Mona Seta, and they should not defile the body of her husband. That's just speculation. That's just a legend. But there were many years where it was believed that Custer's body was stripped but untouched. Kind of a romantic story of Custer's last stand. He fought bravely, and in the end, the warriors did him the service of leaving his body untouched. Recently, it has come to light that this is a bit of an oversimplification. Custer's former lieutenant, Edward Godfrey, had an interview, but it was kept quiet for a very long time out of respect for Libby as well as some of the other wives of the soldiers back home. But in reality, and I hesitated to even mention this, but facts are facts, Custer's body was not mutilated as badly as some, but he did have an arrow jammed up his penis. So the romanticized version of the untouched body of the American, great American warrior, is not true. And that's usually what happens with history. If something is too romanticized to be true, it probably isn't. And that is the end of the Little Bighorn. Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull packed up the village and left, having won a massive victory, but also a victory that basically brought on the demise of their way of life. The United States was not willing to let this go unavenged. Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse became the top targets of the U.S. And Sitting Bull, not willing to surrender, took his people and ran to Canada, where he was able to stay safe for a small amount of time. Crazy Horse was pursued by Colonel Nelson Miles, and his people, in their running, suffered from cold and starvation during the winter. So finally, on May 6, 1877, Crazy Horse surrendered to General Crook at the Red Cloud Agency in Nebraska. General Crook and Crazy Horse did not get along. And long story short, Crook had heard rumors that Crazy Horse had threatened to go on the warpath, and or the rumor that Crazy Horse was going to murder General Crook, and he ordered that Crazy Horse be arrested. Crazy Horse instead fled to the Spotted Tail Agency nearby, hoping to live in peace. None of those rumors were true. He just needed to explain himself, and hopefully he could live in peace. So he explained to Spotted Tail that he never threatened Cook. He just needed to get away from the bad things that people were saying about him at the Red Cloud Agency. I'm not going to get into details, but there was a lot of petty politics among the natives and at the agencies, and Crazy Horse just got caught up in the middle of it. So it was decided that Spotted Tail, Crazy Horse, and an Indian agent named Lee, along with a Minneconjou named Touch the Clouds, who was 7 feet tall, hence his name, would go to Camp Robinson nearby and explain the situation the next day on September 6, 1877. So they left the day before, September 5. Crazy Horse thought he was going to talk to a man named Colonel Bradley at Fort Robinson, but instead it was later in the day. Bradley did not want to talk that day. He said he would talk to him in the morning, and he ordered Crazy Horse to be put in the guardhouse, which is a pleasant name for the prison. Crazy Horse immediately revolted from the idea of being imprisoned. He pulled a concealed knife and rushed for the door. And in the scuffle, he was bayoneted once in the side and once in the back through his kidney. He collapsed. He was carried by Touch the Clouds into an office and laid on a bed. And sometime later, roughly around midnight of September 5, 1877, in the presence of his father, Worm, and Touch the Clouds, Crazy Horse died from his wounds. It's a sad situation. Crazy Horse, after years of battling, being untouched in the wars that he fought, finally meets his end by being bayoneted in the back. And to make the situation even worse, during the actual scuffle, when he is killed, his arms were held by an Oglala Sioux tribesman. So the man who fought most bravely for the continuation of his ancestral way of life and to protect his people was in the end betrayed by his own tribesmen that allowed the soldier to kill him. Sad situation. But in the end, you just kind of knew that's how it was going to go. There was no happy ending for Crazy Horse. Crazy Horse, it was either death or surrender. And for him, probably couldn't decide which one of those was worse. Custer, I think Custer would probably be pretty happy about the fact that century and a half later, some amateur in his basement is on a podcast still talking about the things that Custer did. I'm sure he didn't want to go out in a last stand, but if he had to go out some way, I'm sure somewhere he's glad that people are still talking about it. It's a good story. It's a good story. Crazy Horse, Custer, two legends of the American West, doing what they had to do, doing what they thought was right. And in the end, going out in a way that people remember decades after they lived. That's where I'm going to end it. My name is Brett Bielsma. I am the host of the Curiosity Chronicles. I hope that you stay curious.